This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Lotus Sutra. The Buddha speaking said, at such a time there was a bodhisattva named Never Disparaging. This bodhisattva, whatever persons he happened to meet, whether they were monks or nuns, laymen or laywomen, would bow in obeisance to all of them and speak words of praise, saying, I have profound reverence for you. I would never dare treat you with disparagement or arrogance. Why? Because you are all practicing the Buddha way and are certain to attain Buddhahood. This bodhisattva did not devote their time to reading or reciting the scriptures, but simply went about bowing to people. And if they happened to see any of the four kinds of believers, monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, off in the distance, they would purposefully go to where they were, bow to them, and speak words of praise, saying, I would never dare disparage you, because you are all certain to attain Buddhahood. The bodhisattva path in Buddhism is understood to take the whole of our lives. And if you believe in rebirth, then the whole of our lives, many of them. And that there is a kind of inexorable impulse that we have as human beings towards ultimate liberation, attaining Buddhahood. Because each and every one of us wants to move away from what is life destroying, what is hurtful, what is painful, and to move towards what is life affirming. And all of the great qualities of the enlightened being that are part of that. An attentive person would say, well, if that's true, then why aren't we all busy doing that? Why is there so much active creating of harm, active destruction of life? And what we come to understand in Buddhism is that that impulse is functioning all the time towards good and away from what's harmful, but it gets all tangled up and misdirected because of our delusion, because of our upside-down ways of seeing things. And so in a sense, practice is liberating. Liberation itself is liberating those false views so that that basic impulse that we have can be freed to continue its work, in a sense, but now in actual skillfulness. And so this bodhisattva, this great being, never disparaging. This is from a chapter of the Lotus Sutra called the Never Disparaging Buddha. Has deep reverence, is never arrogant. Has devoted their whole life to alleviating suffering, to spreading loving kindness to all those who are on the path of liberation. And you could read this as those that this bodhisattva is bowing to practitioners who are on the path of the Buddha, certain to attain Buddhahood, or you could see it as bowing to all beings. Those who don't even know what a Buddha is, have never heard the word, because we're all moving along that path. And so this Buddha bodhisattva wants to raise bodhicitta within the minds of others, the way-seeking mind, that they themselves want to alleviate suffering for themselves and for others. This bodhisattva applies that to everyone equally, because everyone wants that. And so they don't discriminate. And they do that through their selfless compassion, in this case, going up and bowing to them and saying, I would never disrespect you. And doing that in an effort to effect real change, freedom from attachments, from desires, from false views. We bring ourselves to the Dharma. We have all brought ourselves here today. We are sitting on this Bodhi seat, even if you don't know what that is. You're sitting on one. We come to this place of training, this training hall. It's important to understand that this is not a meditation hall. It's a hall where we practice meditation, but it's a training hall. It's a place where we train in the Bodhisattva path. We train in the Buddha way. That's different. And we do that freely. We each brought ourselves here, I hope. No one coerced you into coming here. Willingly, eagerly, perhaps. And in so doing, we begin to cultivate right understanding. We begin to understand the power of our thoughts and intentions and desires and begin to practice that. Not just have that most powerful force just be out there shooting in the dark. We practice the precepts, the moral teachings of the Buddha. We strive to integrate the path and our aspirations and our vows into our thoughts, words, and actions. We're supported by teachers, lineages of teachers going back to the Buddha. We have senior students as guides and models. We have students all around us, good friends. And while we do that and cultivating all of these essential virtues, which are all present within us, we have moments of struggle. And those moments of struggle are directed sometimes towards ourselves, sometimes to others, sometimes in all directions. We feel resistance. We feel apathy. We get angry. We're afraid. We become impatient. We're irritated. We have doubt. And again, these can all go in both directions. We can have moments of giving up. We give up. And then we start again. And then we give up. And then we start again. Where we blame, we make excuses, all of this is part of what arises. We call it Mara. We call it mind. And all of this for us here is happening within what is arguably the most favorable of conditions. In the midst of the three treasures. And so as we are cultivating this great bodhisattva life dedicated to the well-being of self and others in the most favorable conditions amongst good friends, walking this path together, we struggle. And that struggle, we turn outwards towards others, those around us, those we rely upon, those we love. How is it when we're in the midst of or thinking about those who are not seeking wisdom and compassion, who are not on this path, who are not examining the nature of things themselves, who don't give a crap about karma unless it'll sell them something or buy them something, who are not committed to not creating harm, practicing good, actualizing good for others? How is our bodhisattva practice amongst others? In the sutra, it says, among the four kinds of believers, and this is the way the Buddha talked about the Sangha, male and female monastics, male and female laity. The goddess was the original non-binary being of Buddha. Well, actually, the Buddha was. He just didn't talk about it. So among the four kinds of believers, there were those who gave way to anger, their minds lacking in purity, and they spoke ill of this bodhisattva and cursed him, saying, this ignorant person, where do they come from, presuming to declare that they don't disparage me, bestowing upon me a prediction that I will attain Buddhahood. I have no such use for such a vain and irresponsible prediction. It says, many years passed in this way, during which this bodhisattva was constantly subjected to curses and abuse. And they did not give way to anger, however, but each time spoke the same words. You are certain to attain Buddhahood. I would never do anything. I would not dare to treat you with disparagement or arrogance. And they, when the bodhisattva spoke in this way, some amongst the groups that they would be meeting would take up sticks of wood or tiles and stones and beat and pelt this bodhisattva. But even as they ran away, the bodhisattva ran away. He'd just go far enough, and then it would stop and turn around and start bowing and say, I will never disparage you. To have compassion and patience towards those who speak and act out against ourselves or those we love. I wanted to, this morning, invoke again Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech that we listened to last week during our commemoration of his life and his work. I just wasn't finished with it. And hearing his most beautiful voice in this hall. So this speech, I realized he spoke, I was 27 days old when he gave this speech. And just a little to the east of where he was. He gave this speech in Montgomery, Alabama. And so he spoke about quoting the Bible, and he said, in the Bible, you have heard that it has been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But this is Jesus speaking. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them that despitefully use you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. We might read this sutra and think that it's humorous or distantly encouraging. Who could ever live such a life? Who could ever be such a way? And that's why I wanted to bring Dr. King's words, because hearing these words from him, having even a distant sense of his life, of what he experienced, of what he witnessed, these words take on the most greatest of powers. He was not speaking idly or distantly or theoretically. He was such a bodhisattva, never disparaging. And so he goes on to say, certainly these are great words. Words lifted to cosmic proportions, and over the centuries, many people have argued that this is an extremely difficult command. Many would go so far as to say it just isn't possible to move out into the actual practice of this glorious command. They would go on to say that this is just additional proof that Jesus was an impractical idealist who never quite came down to earth, never really saw things from a realistic perspective. And so the arguments abound, but far from being an impractical idealist, Jesus has become the practical realist. The words of this text glitter in our eyes with a new urgency, new today as well. Far from being the pious injunction of a utopian dreamer, this command is an absolute necessity for the survival of our civilization. Yes, it is love that will save our world and our civilization. Love even for our enemies, perhaps love especially for our enemies. And so he's acknowledging this is an extremely difficult command, an extremely difficult vow that we take to love those that we consider our enemies. And for the sake of examination and practice, we should, why not just consider our enemies? Because we might think, well, I don't have any enemies. Really? If we think of enemies as all of those who we are afraid of, that we have anger towards, that we feel hatred for, that we resent, that we wish would go away, that we want to harm or wish would be harmed, that we would like to conquer or see defeated, or that we have jealousy and envy for. And that these enemies can move back and forth. They might be a lifelong enemy. They might be your enemy for 4 years or eight. They might be an enemy for a moment. And then a moment later, your friend or your partner. And so we should consider enemies expansively, because that's the power of the mind. Is to in one moment forget the love that we have for the person, or if for a whole lifetime forget the possibility of love that we can have for this person. And this is the great love of the Bodhisattva, karuna, selfless compassion. And it is the most challenging of all our commitments. And it arises from the deep faith in Buddhism, from the deep faith in. And ultimately the realization is that is the direct experience that this is the essential nature of the world. As Dr. King says, it is an absolute necessity for our survival. Now we could say that's because if we don't bring forth this love, we will kill ourselves, right? We're pretty good at that. We know how to do that in more ways than is needed. But we could also say it's an absolute necessity for our survival because it's the essence of our being. And to even live and survive within hatred is not actually living. And while this great love has a moral basis and is the stuff of our moral action, in Buddhism, it's the essential nature of reality. So it's not just, you know, it's like, are the precepts and the moral teachings of Buddhism, are they presented to us and offered as guides because we need them? Or do they appear because they are an expression of the true nature of things? And if we don't heed their call and take up that challenge, then we will never find peace, because we will never be in accord with the nature of things. And so the survival can't just be to continue living and breathing and propagating and buying things, but to live as true human beings, as Dr. King says, as the children of God, as the never disparaging Bodhisattva says, as Buddha. And so what this means is the only true path. It's not the only possible path, but it's the only true one. Which I think is why when we're practicing, no matter how difficult it gets at times, no matter how lonely, no matter how much doubt we have, may have, that if we pay attention, if we look closely, I think we will always see, despite all of our arguments and reasons for denial, that although it's all of those things, that there is this inner sense that it is a true path, albeit often not an easy one. He says, many have argued and argue still that this is just not possible. Bodhisattvas really just don't have a lot of time for that, because it just goes on and on and on. And there can be great arguments. And then what? Wendell Berry talks about it as the, you know, everybody gets together and talks about the world going to hell, nodding in agreement, feeling good in their agreement. And he says, it's the ain't it awful conversation. We all agree, ain't it awful? All right, now, let's go back to work. What have we done? And yet it feels good. And so the Bodhisattva part of our practice is to generate fearlessness, courage. Never disparaging is also never discouraging. And so not being discouraged by the vastness and variety of human suffering. Infinitely varied, right? We are endlessly creative. Not discouraged by how many people are suffering, how many beings. And not discouraged by how long the work is. And that's why in practice, it's really important to carefully consider when we take vows, to not do that casually. That's why in our Sangha, people don't take formal vows for at least a couple of years. So that we know what we're doing enough that we can with open eyes take those vows, because we will be tried to the depth of our being. We will be tried in equal measure to the sincerity of those vows. If we take them lightly, we'll be tried lightly because we're not really engaging them. If we engage them deeply, we will have many, many great trials to live them. I mean, I feel like I get my ass kicked all the time. By you? By us? Comes from all corners. Dr. King said, "Now let me hasten to say that Jesus was very serious when he gave this command. He wasn't playing. He realized that it's hard to love your enemies. He realized it's difficult to love those persons who seek to defeat you, those persons who say evil things about you." Remember who's speaking these words. He realized it was painfully hard, pressingly hard, but he wasn't playing. We have the Christian and moral responsibility to seek to discover the meaning of these words and to see how can we live out this command and why should we live out this command? Why should we do this? It's a really important question. Because if we don't know, are we just following a command? How long is that going to last? All of the masters, the great masters of all the great traditions, all the bodhisattvas, were not playing around. Although, as we say, they were frequently playing freely within inner and outer samadhi, while they went about the most serious of work. Why? Because people are suffering. And their seriousness sometimes can be off-putting. Particularly if we think that my life is good. What's the deal here? But they're trying to get our attention, to convey something, some sense of the reality that we are in the midst of. I told this story recently when I was a teenager and I'd gotten into some trouble and I was standing before a judge in court and I was, you know, being a teenage punk and thinking, I'm in control here. I know what's doing. You know, I was airy. I was a teenager, right? Not yet ready, not yet fit for like being out on the streets. And I don't know what I was saying, but my father popped me on the back of the head hard. And that was only the second time he ever spanked me. The first time I was about six, five. I crossed the street when I wasn't allowed to. This was more serious. Because he was trying to get my attention. Something's happening here. You don't see it. The great poet Rumi said, "My desire body, don't come strolling over this way. Sit where you are. That's a good place. When you want dessert, you choose something rich. In wine, you look for what is clear and firm. What's the rest? The rest is mirages and blurry pictures and milk mixed with water. The rest is self-hatred and mocking other people and bombing. So just be quiet. Sit down. The reason is you are drunk, and this is the edge of the roof. And we do need to hear that voice, because so often, we do not understand what we are in the midst of. I mean, when we encounter the first noble truth, if bodhicitta is risen, we have a sense of it. But it's still, I think for almost all of us, embryonic. It's still we're just starting to get a sense. We have a responsibility. We have received this human life. We are in an intimately codependent relationship with every being in every aspect, known and unknown, conceivable and inconceivable. And so to discover the meaning of these words and how to live them out and why we should live them out is really what our life should be about. And so we examine, we encounter the Dharma, we study it, we reflect, we put it into practice. We aspire to realize it. So Dr. King says, so let us deal with the practical question. How do you do this? How do you go about loving your enemies? In order to love your enemies, you must begin by analyzing yourself. And then he goes on to say how surprising that may be to many of those in the audience. Hopefully it doesn't surprise any of you that we have to begin by understanding this one, the one on your cushion. What we see within is what we create without. There's no truth, true peace between us, if there's no true peace within us. Dr. King said, now I'm aware of the fact that some people will not like you, not because of something you have done to them, but just they won't like you. But there is something that we might have done deep down in the past that aroused the hatred response within that individual. And so he's saying part of that analysis is to examine in this relationship in which there is hatred that I direct towards them, that they direct towards me, whether it's a person or a group, is there something I have done? We can think of this as when a group of people acts in a way that brings forth the hatred of others, when a group of people who are lovers of equality and justice and diversity and compassion act in out of that love to create such a world that it will arouse the hatred of those who do not want that world, who cannot see that world. And so if we have created harm, then that's our practice, to take responsibility for that, to repair. If it's that hatred is arousing because we are trying to bend the arc towards justice, and those who are opposed to that, as some of the most powerful people in our culture, the country, the upholders of our democracy, don't actually like democracy. Not lovers of democracy. If we inspire their hatred, then we love them. Dr. King says, another thing that we must do in seeking to love our enemy is to discover the element of good in our enemy. And every time you begin to hate that person, to think of hating that person, or think of hating that person, realize that there is some good there. And look at those good points, which will overbalance the bad points. I've said to you on many occasions that in each of us there's something of a schizophrenic personality. We're split up and divided against ourselves. And there's something of a civil war going on within all of our lives. How true is this? Dragons and snakes intermingle. Ordinary beings and sages live together intimately. And so what he's saying is that from a Buddhist perspective, is that our views, our perspectives within that hatred, becomes very myopic. That's what we see. And what we look for are the things that are going to feed that hatred, build up, solidify it, justify it, affirm it. And what he's saying is expand our view. See the whole being. We have to do this within ourselves. When we reduce ourselves to one thing. And so the immeasurable of sympathetic joy, to have sympathetic joy towards ourselves, to see all of the good qualities. When we get soured or grief-stricken or just cynical about the state of the world, to open up our view and see all of the miracles and incredible acts of kindness and just outrageous beauty that exists here. See it larger. And in that, it becomes larger, because it is. But in our mind, when it becomes larger, there is space for compassion. So Dr. King goes on to talk about the different kinds of love. There's eros, there's the sentimental, or rather, aesthetic or romantic, sexualized love. There's philia, there's the love of friendship, companionship, brotherhood, sisterhood, a familial kind of love. And then he says there's agape, which is something of the understanding, the creative, the redemptive goodwill of all people. It's a love that seeks nothing in return. It is an overflowing love. It's what theologians would call the love of God working in the lives of people. And when you rise to love on this level, you begin to love people. Not because they're likable, but because God loves them. And so maybe what's rising in that person is God. In Buddhism, we see that as the naturally arising compassion and love within selflessness, within our non-attachments. It is our attachments that create that tight, tight confinement within ourselves. And the fear and the anxiety and the stinginess that keeps everything held in because we're afraid of losing. And so in our letting go, we're liberating ourselves. We're stepping into that boundlessness. And the Bodhisattva seeks nothing, gives without expecting return, is not looking for recognition, is not attached to an outcome, which is most difficult when the outcome may be our survival. Right? How about that? To be dedicated towards what is good, what is compassion, what is love. Recognizing that that will affect change, and yet without attaching to that change. As he goes on to say, this love, he speaks about it in more detail, but he speaks about how this love is not based on personality or sentiment or behavior. It is. It is the heart of the Bodhisattva. It's like the essence of the precept, practice good. Where? When? For whom? Practice good. Be that good itself. Dr. King says, this is what Jesus means, I think, in this very passage when he says, love your enemy. And it's significant that he doesn't say, like your enemy. Like is a sentimental something, an affectionate something. He says, there are a lot of people I find it difficult to like. I don't like what they do to me. I don't like what they say about me and other people. I don't like their attitudes. I don't like some of the things they're doing. And yet you refuse to do anything that will defeat an individual because you have agape, or this boundless love in your heart, in your soul. And in our tradition, that means going beyond liking and disliking. finding that ground of being within ourself that is no longer based in that, although it recognizes it. No longer dependent upon that, although it can use it. He talks about why we should love our enemies. He says, first, because hatred for those who hate only intensifies the existence of hate and evil in the universe. I mean, this is just logically true, right? Like, if we're generating something, hatred, we're bringing that into being. We're bringing that into universe. We're making more of that. But it's also fundamentally true. It's existentially true. It's spiritually true. It's true in more ways than we know. And it is just like every gift. It cannot be controlled once it's set loose in the universe. Dr. King says it just never ends. Somewhere, somebody must have a little sense. And that's the strong person, the bodhisattva, the never disparaging person. The strong person is a person who can cut off the chain of hate, the chain of evil. And that is the tragedy of hate, that it doesn't cut it off. Hatred never stops hatred. War never ends war. That's the nature of karma. It's a law of the universe. We can't manipulate it. We're not going to beat it, no matter how clever we are. He said it only intensifies the existence of hate and evil in the universe. Somebody must have religion enough, morality enough to cut it off. He's giving us a challenge. Who is that somebody? And to inject it, he says, within the very structure of the universe, that strong and powerful element of love. In other words, break the cycle. Somebody has to be willing to break the cycle. Trungpa Rinpoche said that great compassion, the bodhisattva, is the one who's willing to go first. You know, you're standing face to face, you both got a grudge, there's a lot of history. You know, you apologize first. I'm not apologizing first. You go first. I'm not going first. The bodhisattva just jumps in. Dr. King is calling that a strong person. That strong person has that much courage, but also that much tenderness, that willingness to be vulnerable, that gentleness. It's not aggressive or controlling, but it can be fierce. Dr. King says that hate distorts the personality of the hater, the skandhas. It creates them. It creates them in the image of hatred. He says it's tragic. It's that hatred is even more ruinous and injurious to the individual who hates. He said you just begin hating somebody and you begin to do irrational things. You can't see straight when you hate. You can't walk straight. You can't stand upright. Your vision gets distorted. There's nothing more tragic than to see an individual whose heart is filled with hatred. They come to the point that becomes pathological. Ain't that so? For the person who hates, you can stand up and see a person, and that person is beautiful, but you will call them ugly. For the person who hates, the beautiful becomes ugly, and the ugly becomes beautiful. Hatred becomes a distorted form of love. It's not love. For the person who hates, the good becomes bad, and the bad becomes good. The world turns upside down. The true becomes false, and the false becomes true. He must have studied Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma said, when you do not understand the nature of things, all that is true appears false. When you do understand, all that appeared false, now you see is true. And I was thinking about how interesting it is in terms of beautiful and ugly. You know, aesthetics, that sense of aesthetics. that we have within us, and that need, that yearning, that delight in what is beautiful. Like, why? Like, what, from an evolutionary point of view, what function is that? That's not feeding your belly. It's not keeping you warm. It's not putting a roof over your head. Right? Evelyn Underhill talked about this in her book on mysticism. And yet without it, we're not fully human. We're not living a human life. And that then when we see the embodiment of hatred, it's just a person that in one moment appears as ugly, aesthetically. They're just having an emotion. And yet we visually experience it, emotionally experience it as ugly. And then a few moments later, or a day later, or another lifetime later, they break into a smile. And they're gorgeous. Same person. It's just a different energy. Isn't it interesting that we perceive hatred and kindness aesthetically as it manifests in our face? Like, isn't that just amazing? Doesn't it make you wonder? How deep does that go? And then Dr. King says, the final reason he thinks Jesus says love your enemies is this. Love has within it a redemptive power. There is a power that eventually transforms individuals. That's why Jesus says love your enemies. Because if you hate your enemies, you have no way to redeem and transform them. That when we hate those who hate, that's what's expected. That's following the plan. That's exactly what is expected. Their desire is fulfilled. You know, I was talking about when, it's not necessarily a great analogy, but I was talking about yesterday when, about, you know, watch out for the dog. And that I was telling the story about when I used to encounter on these bike trips, really mangy, aggressive dogs riding down country roads, you know, and how many times a dog would be coming after us and their owner would be in the front yard saying, oh, don't worry, he won't bite you. I mean, rah, 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 rah. And, you know, I mean, we tried everything. I'd take up my pump and swat it. I'd, you know, just try and outrun it, all kinds of things. And then one day, just out of sheer desperation, I started throwing some love at it. Hey, boy, come here, boy, come here. And it was like, it was, you know, how they do. Completely threw them off guard. Unfortunately, that didn't always work. But to hate, I mean, we know this. And so what is that really bringing us to the foundation of? Their desire to transform. That being hated, hating back, what does that do? What does that do for us? Hating in return. We become that hatred. And so to be on a path of awakening, to be on the bodhisattva path, that is not our aspiration. That is not what we want of this life. And moreover, it's not just not what we want of my life, it's not what I want of your life. Of all those, in every moment, who are filled with hatred. And so it means really connecting with that fundamental core of compassion for others. Experiencing that in others and feeling that anger, that hatred arise, that desire to have them just gone, defeated, conquered, of wanting rather, because then it just goes somewhere else, of wanting it transformed. How can it be transformed? All of the great beings who have known this truth have said only through love, only through compassion. He says, if you love your enemies, you will discover that at the very root of love is the power of redemption. You just keep loving people and keep loving them, even though they're hating you, even though they're mistreating you. And this is the great challenge. Because it's such a deep reaction, being hurt to hurt back. Having angered us to come back with anger. It's very old. But we have consciousness. That is our gift. That is our power. We can see this well-worn path and choose another one. And so for us in Buddhism, we don't talk so much of redemption, but more the fulfillment of this liberation journey. Love has the power to affect change in the minds and bodies of beings. Master Dogen said, in terms of bringing forth kind, loving kindness and compassion, the human mind is the most difficult thing to change. So just keep having compassion for human beings, sentient beings. And what's important to understand is that this in no way inhibits or prevents us from acting. To love those who are hating us, mistreating others, mistreating us, doesn't in any way obviate the capacity to act in ways that is trying to change that, transform that, stop that. And from the perspective of the Bodhisattva, in that we're not only stopping other people from being hurt, but stopping the person who is creating the harm from harming others and themselves. And so it in no way is suggesting apathy or complacence or indifference towards suffering. I mean, remember who is speaking these words, what his life was about. And then finally he talks about, and remember this was in 1957, before so much of this great work was really taken up. He says, our whole world is facing a revolution. Our nation is facing a revolution. And I thought about that. Did that begin, our revolution in this country, begin at the beginning of the American Revolution? Did it begin when that ended? Was it its mandate signed on July 4th, 1776? He says, one of the things that concerns me most is that in the midst of this revolution and in the midst of this nation, that we will discover the meaning of Jesus' words. There he said, there are different ways we rise up against oppression, against injustice, against hatred. He said, one way is to rise up with physical violence and corroding hatred. But he says, but oh, this is not the way. For the danger and the weakness of this method is its very futility, inherent within its strategy. Violence creates many more social problems than it solves. Violence, that's what it creates. All forms of violence. He says, violence cannot be the way. We have enough history to show us this. Another way is to acquiesce and to give in. Just resign yourself to the oppression. Some people do that. They discover the difficulties of the wilderness, moving into the promised land, and they would rather just go back to the despots of Egypt because it's difficult to get in the promised land. We just go back to our old ways. Once you pass through that door, can you? Can you? What kind of self-shifting has to happen to forget what we've seen, what we felt, what we know? He says, but that too isn't the way, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. The great harm of silence, of apathy. He says, but there is another way, of course. And he speaks of organizing mass nonviolent resistance based on the principles of love. He says, it seems to me this is the only way as our eyes look to the future. And as we look across the years and across the generations, let us develop and move right here. And so here in his words, this is the vision of the Bodhisattva. They recognize, he recognized, he has a moment. He has a moment that he's calling his life. He doesn't know how long it lasts. We don't know how long it lasts. He's living his life, not just for him. The Bodhisattva is living their life, not just for themselves. They're looking to those years ahead, to those generations ahead. In a way, like parents, friends, like anyone who cares, that wants not just to take care of today, but wants to really ensure that all those that you love will be as best taken care of as possible. And so what do we do now to better ensure that? He says we must discover the power of love, the power, the redemptive power of love. And when we discover that, we will be able to make of this old world a new world. We will be able to be better people. Love is the only way. This is what Jesus discovered, and the Buddha, and countless others, in their own paths, speaking of it in their own language, and realizing different aspects of that reality. But it all, there's one common essential truth that comes through over and over and over again. And so this Bodhisattva, never disparaging, not so far-fetched. And the power of practice is practice itself. And so that when that anger arises, when hatred arises, in all of its force and fury, as a practitioner, you know what to do. And if you don't, you can work at it. You can seek counsel. You can ask for guidance. You can take an action that will move you in the direction of knowing what to do. And in knowing what to do, you practice it. And that becomes stronger, because that's the nature of karma. And that gift goes out in all directions. And to appreciate that this is, you know, compassion, love, these words are so comforting and soothing. They're ass kickers. So there are certainly, of course, there are many moments that are soft and lovely and comforting. But loving our enemies takes us out of our place of comfort and brings us right into the middle of reality, of the wilderness of today. And I consider in my own life this the greatest of challenges, the greatest of practices, which means we have to learn how to fall and fall and fall, and to turn that love towards oneself so that you can rise again. No one should think that this is, you know, a faultless, flawless path. But it is a true path. It is a practice. It is a human path. All of these teachers are talking about our lives. They're not talking about some made-up, you know, otherworldly thing. And I think that as we move into our succession of today's, not only will we be, but we are being called. And if we respond in this way, to whatever degree we respond in this way, the world is coming to life in that. We are coming to life in that.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.